And now on WRS, Michael McKay with the McKay Interview.
Hello, everyone. It's not often that I get the chance to pick up a conversation, a radio conversation, some 9 years after I started it. But I have the privilege today of sitting in front of an old friend, David Willey. And looking at the calendar of past events, I see that we last had a conversation on the McKay Interview in June, and we're in June right now, 2013, and here we are in June 2022. And for those of you young ones listening who don't know David Willey, he's something of a legend in the BBC. He's a papal biographer and a former BBC correspondent for the Vatican for more years than most of us can remember. In fact, I remember as a young boy listening to David Willey on the BBC World Service, and it's just a real privilege to be sitting here in his apartment in a place not far from Rome. I can't remember the name of the village right now, but he'll tell us as we have the conversation. And we're going to talk about various things in a very sort of relaxed and amatory way. And I just want to say, David, thank you for welcoming me home.
Well, I'm delighted to have a reprise of the conversation because it's 10 years, almost 10 years now, since we last talked. And it's 10 years since, getting on for 10 years, since Pope Francis was elected, the first ever Pope from Latin America.
But before we go down that road, you did tell me something which I didn't know before, but a little bit about yourself, that you actually have a genetic connection with the country you've made your home for many, many years.
Yes, I did. I am the grandchild of Italian grandparents who migrated from northern Italy, from Venice, actually, to London in 1893. I know quite a lot about it because I've been doing some research on my family recently. And my grandfather was the son. He came from a large family. His mother was widowed when her husband was in his 40s, and she was left with 10 children. And they were all given a trade. And my grandfather became what's known as an ebenista in Italian, an ebeniste in French, a cabinet maker. He made fine furniture. And indeed, in my dining room today, I still have the dining table and chairs that he made as a wedding present for my mother in 1930. Just imagine.
So we started our conversation before we turned the microphone on, David, and you told me that you were born actually in High Wycombe and that you had a father from Bolton. You were just telling us about that. But what interests me and what we have time to discuss, particularly as you're here in Rome or near Rome, and you've made your life's home here, so to speak, you, a bit like me, have lived more of your life outside of Britain than in Britain, is to talk a little bit about what you see and what you hear about what's going on in the Vatican these days and what's likely to happen if you care to speculate or look into the future. But how would you put the situation today of the Roman Catholic Church if you had to summarise it?
I think the Catholic Church, like all institutions, is facing a major crisis, or rather a series of crises. The first is, of course, I think, a diminution in the number of believers. I think that in many parts of the world, and particularly in North America and in Europe, people have been leaving the church in droves. Why? Well, because traditional religion perhaps no longer has the attraction that it once did and the universality that it once did in the more developed parts of the world. And secondly, I think because of a series of misfortunes that the church has undergone, namely scandal.
Self-inflicted
scandal because of the sexual abuse crisis, which has involved clergy in many parts of the world. I began reporting about this more than 20 years ago, when the Vatican dismissed the allegations of sexual abuse of children by priests as an American problem. In fact, I remember that we there was a big scandal in the Diocese of Boston in the United States, which ended up with the Cardinal Archbishop of Boston, Cardinal Law, having to leave and come. He came to live in Rome, here in Rome, where I got to know him. He was a very amiable person, but I think he didn't appreciate the gravity of what was going on in his diocese.
Can I ask you, can I just interrupt you there before you go on to the second and third point I know you're going to make? Just to ask you just to give some insights based on your experience of what you think goes on in the minds of senior men, because most of these bishops were, you know, getting on past middle age, that they would conceal that and not do anything about it.
I think it was part of the culture in the seminaries that there were quite a lot of gay people who were attracted by studying for the priesthood, and there was a certain latitude given to gay people in the church, and particularly to gay clergy. Nobody seemed to worry very much about it. Of course, we're not just talking about gay people, we're talking actually about active sexual abusers, and this of course is quite unforgivable in an organization like the Catholic Church. It's been interesting over the years to observe how different countries have dealt with the crisis of sexual abuse. In Britain, for example, we had a cardinal in charge of the church, Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor, who was clever enough to involve a local judge, a High Court judge, Lord Nolan, in carrying out an independent investigation.
And this is the Nolan. This is the Nolan of the Nolan Report.
That's right. Yeah. Which brought to light a very scandalous situation. Then, of course, there was the scandal of there were various scandals in Ireland. And watching the Catholic Church from this vantage point of Rome, gradually, most countries, it emerged, had reported cases of sexual abuse by priests, which were then glossed over, first of all by the local hierarchy, and then even by the police of the countries concerned. So it's taken a very long time, decades in fact, for the church to come to grips with it. Pope Francis has set up various committees to try to deal with the situation, of which he realizes the gravity. But still, here in Italy, it's one of the few countries in the world where the local bishops have not yet agreed to carry out an internal investigation and to try to bring to justice priests who have committed crimes of sexual abuse against children.
Why set up a committee and not just call in the police?
Good question. The police very often have been reluctant to prosecute, and then of course the delays of Italian justice are legion, and it takes a lot of time for cases to come to court. And there are various possibilities of appeal and various chances, I suppose, for local bishops to try to deflect attention from such cases. But there is an active organisation dealing with this very distasteful subject, which tries, they have a website and a series of activists who work on their behalf, and I would say the situation is better than it has been in the past, but leaves still much to be desired.
And the impact of this on the church has been what now, your observation?
The impact has been to try and brush it under the carpet. That's been the traditional way. It's been the case in America. It's been the case in South America, in Mexico. It's been the case in France, Spain, Germany, Switzerland. I think you have you've had many cases. The French bishops finally appeared to have realised the gravity, and they have set up a very effective, it seems to me, internal inquiry. We shall wait and see if this does lead to convictions and to action by the church authorities to remove forever from contact with young people, priests who've been convicted or accused of sexual misbehaviour.
And the outcome, I mean, the outcome on the church has been a decline in the number of vocations.
Clearly, this has been one of the reasons why the church has been declining in its power and influence in many parts of the world. Although I must say that what I've been able to observe over recent decades is a general transfer of church power from the rich and developed world to the poorer South. One of the great initiatives undertaken by Pope Francis, it seems to me, has to be to try to bring the church's message to neglected parts of the world. He wants the Catholic Church to be what it's always claimed to be, that is to say, a universal church, which is going to be acceptable and attract believers from every part of the world. And he has been particularly keen on addressing the Christian message to what he calls the periphery, the outer places, the far-off places, which perhaps have a very small Catholic population, but which he feels are still it's still important that Rome should realise that countries with a large Catholic flock do deserve particular attention and particular administrative attention, but also small groups of Catholics deserve an equal attention from their pastors. And he has, for example, one of the recent his recent decisions is he still plans, if his health stands up to it, to visit Canada in July 2022. In the summer, he plans to go to Edmonton, which is one of the northernmost cities in the United States. He'll visit Quebec, and then on his way back to Rome, he's going to an Inuit community right in the far north of Canada, in a place where perhaps there are it's a small town with an airstrip and a road, which I was reading leads officially to nowhere. It's ice and snow most of the year round. But there is a small Catholic community there, and he wants to show the universality of the church by going to visit this outpost of Rome.
That's interesting. But you mentioned Pope Francis's health, and you showed me a photograph before we started this conversation of the Pope in a wheelchair. Can you tell us a little bit more about the implications of that? Because he's now in his 10th year, and I think he's in his mid-80s, right?
He's not been very well recently. He's taken to a wheelchair as a result of some kneeling trouble. He's been limping for some time, but for the past month he's been wheeled around, attending general audiences and so on, in a wheelchair. He doesn't take this very seriously, apparently. He has told one journalist who interviewed him, he said, "You don't need a knee to run the church, you need a head." But he clearly is diminished from how he's been for most of his pontificate, although I must add that since his early days as a student, he caught, I think, tuberculosis, and he had one of his lungs was operated on in his youth. So he's never been, he's never enjoyed very robust health during his lifetime, but he's held up pretty well, and he's carried out a very vigorous program of foreign travel for many years now, although this does seem to have quietened down, because recently he was planning trips to the Congo and to Sudan, if I'm right, this month, and both these trips were cancelled because of his indisposition.
And David, is it just speculation or gossip that he might contemplate retirement? And if that were to be the case, what on earth happens if you have three popes bumping into each other in the Vatican?
What indeed. There's been a lot of speculation about his possible retirement. In fact, right from the beginning of his papacy, when he took over from Pope Benedict, who, as you may remember, resigned. He was the first pope to resign since the 13th century. It was a very unusual event. Pope Benedict, it's never been quite clear why he decided to resign. Of course, he's still alive. He's very frail. He's in his mid-90s now. He lives inside the Vatican. It seems to me to have been a bit of a problem for Pope Francis to have an ex-pope living, as it were, on his doorstep. Ex-Pope Benedict has behaved very well. He doesn't try to interfere in the running of the church, but he still wears the papal white cassock. It was thought that it would be more appropriate that he should return to the black cassock of the Catholic clergy when he did retire. But no, he still regards himself as Pope. He chose the title as Pope Emeritus, and he lives in a rather nice converted nunnery at the top of the Vatican Garden.
I see.
As the crow flies, it's only about 500 metres from where the Pope lives.
That close?
That close, just around the corner. They do occasionally meet, but I think both realise that they each have different jobs to do. And of course, Pope Benedict was a serious academic for much of his life, and I think he's very glad to have been able to continue reading his books and writing his theological treatises in peace and quiet in the Vatican during the past 9 years.
And you're saying that he publishes under the title of Pope Emeritus, is that?
That's right.
That's what he does. That's
right.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Yes.
So just like
Professor Emeritus. I mean, he was a university professor.
Yes. So, David, let me push it a little bit harder. Take us on that intellectual leap that something, heaven forbid, should happen, and Pope Francis retires too.
Well,
what on earth would happen then?
Quite frankly, I don't quite know where he would live.
I wasn't thinking of where he would live, David.
His own living quarters were the subject of amazement right from the start. You may remember that for hundreds of years now, popes have lived in a very beautiful Renaissance building called the Apostolic Palace at the Vatican, which traditionally the penthouse apartment at the top has been the Pope's private apartment. But when Pope Francis was elected, he was taken up in the lift to the top of the building, opened the door, took one look inside and said, there looks to be enough room in here for 200 people. I'm not going to live here. He said, switch off the light. I'm going back to the hotel, where, in fact, the cardinals who elected him had been living. There's a building right next door to St. Peter's called Santa Marta. It's an interesting building. It was constructed originally at the end of the 19th century as a temporary a sort of hospital, a quarantine centre, because Rome in those days was subject not to the plague but to occasional outbreaks of cholera. And this building was originally constructed as a quarantine centre. In fact, it luckily was not needed because the outbreak was brought under control. But later on, it was used as office buildings during the Second World War. For example, the British and the American chargé d'affaires of the Vatican, the diplomats who maintained diplomatic contact with the Vatican during the German occupation of Rome, they had their offices there. And then in the 1970s, Pope John Paul II decided that It was rather undignified for a lot of old gentlemen who gather in Rome for the election of a pope to have to live on camp beds and with screens set up and a distinct lack of bathrooms in the Vatican buildings, which are old and often rather decrepit. So he had the building converted into what really amounts to a modern hotel with room for about 200 guests. And VIPs stay at the Vatican, and when there's a conclave, the cardinals who gather in Rome from all over the world live in this Santa Marta. But Pope Francis has continued to live there. He takes his meals in the cafeteria. He lives very simply in a three-room suite. He has an office, a bedroom, and another small room, and a private bathroom. And he is protected, of course, by Vatican security. He has a Swiss guard.
A Swiss guard, yeah.
Sleeping.
We're going to come to Switzerland in a moment.
Standing outside his bedroom every night. He occasionally opens the door and gives him something to drink.
Good. So, David, listen, for those arriving late to the program, my guest today is my friend David Woolley, the papal biographer and former BBC correspondent for many, many, many years for the Vatican, and I'm sitting with him in his flat, not far from Rome. And I wanted to cover two more things, David, just before we come to the end of it. For those people who are listening, who might care and might be interested, please explain to me and to them, and I must declare an interest, I have a late uncle who was a Jesuit priest in Jamaica. What's the significance of having a Jesuit pope? And after 10 years of the pope being in that position of authority, the Jesuit pope, what difference has it made in your experience, in your opinion?
I think the Jesuits have a reputation as educators, which is really puts them at the top of the church clergy because of the great discipline. Don't forget that Saint Ignatius, the founder of the Jesuits, adopted sort of military language and military style.
This is Ignatius Loyola.
Loyola, yeah. Yes, who. Founded this religious order, which has been dissolved actually several times,
and expelled from Switzerland once,
and actually dissolved in Rome, but they made a comeback, and they're still quite a powerful group of people, and they managed to maintain very, very high educational standards in the schools which they run all over the world, schools and universities. Even in countries which are not traditionally Catholic, for example, it's interesting that one of the leading universities in Tokyo, in Japan, which has a tiny Catholic population, something like half of 1%, one of the leading universities in Tokyo is that run by the Jesuits.
And I should declare an interest that there are two Jesuit schools in Kingston, Jamaica, and I had the privilege of teaching in one of them, St. George's College and Campion College in Kingston, to mention other places.
In his many travels around the world, the Pope always makes it a point, whenever he's visiting a major city, to meet with the local Jesuit fathers and to have a private discussion with them about the problems they're facing. So although he's running the whole show, as it were, he still feels a great loyalty towards his fellow members of the Jesuit order.
And you've seen a lot of popes. I think you said to me five. One didn't stay very long, sadly, and he died. But tell me, what difference has Pope Francis made in 10 years, do you think?
I think he has brought a fresh look at what it means to be a Catholic in a fast-changing world. You may remember, studied science before he started his religious studies for the priesthood, and in his one of his most important encyclical letters, which is called Laudato Si, Praise Be. The whole preamble is couched in scientific terms about climate change. He's very worried about the survival of the world as we see it today. He takes into account not only abstruse religious questions, but also very nitty-gritty things like climate change and poverty and justice and human rights. And he's very much a hands-on pope who believes that the education of the Catholic population and of the world also, the Christian religion has a lot to offer.
Let's finish our conversation with the reference to filthy lucre, money, because you said to me before we started the radio conversation that there's a revenue problem.
There is indeed. The Vatican may seem to have fabled riches, but in fact, when it comes down to the nitty-gritty and you look at the balance sheet, which they now publish, incidentally, for years they never, it was very obscure, the question of Vatican finances, but there is a Vatican bank which got into some hot water over money laundering.
And worse than that, I think, at some point, David.
And I think that one can say that there is a bit of a crisis in the donations which keep the church running, because after all, it is a unique organization. It is its own government. Don't forget it. The Vatican, as we see it today, the Holy See, is the successor to the papal states of central Italy, which of course disappeared in 1870
when Italy was unified, one
the
nation,
united
one,
country.
Yeah, exactly.
And for many years in the early 20th century, the Pope considered himself the prisoner of the Vatican. But of course, since Pope Wojtyła, Pope John Paul II, who began this program of extensive worldwide travel, it's become very much more outward-looking. But although the Vatican has been rather tending to go out to see, to visit the flock in many parts of the world, the flock has not always responded with the donations which the Vatican needs to keep running.
So where do the big chunks of money come from?
America and Germany, traditionally. The Americans provide a huge funding, for example, for the Vatican museums. They've been very generous. And then there are various Catholic organizations in the United States, such as the Knights of Columbus, who collect money for the Vatican. And then there's another big fund called Peter's Pence, which invites contributions from Catholic faithful all over the world for the upkeep of the Holy See.
So, David, there are people listening, whether Catholic or non-Catholic, or people who just don't care, who might say, why don't they just sell some of their assets?
Not so simple. They did. They sold off a lot of real estate at the end of the war, World War II. They sold off a lot of real estate in Rome, which they owned. But in fact, when you look at the total balance sheet and assets and liabilities of the Vatican, it's not really much more than a rather small American corporation, public corporation. The finances are really pretty small, and it accomplishes an enormous task with really rather modest means. But it is at the moment in the red, and each year it's going slightly more into the red. And so therefore the Pope Francis, quite rightly, has tried, A, to clean up the image of the Vatican Bank and ensure that these allegations of money laundering are not substantiated, and also to try to increase the contributions so that the very considerable running expenses of the church can be met without going into deep debt. But, you know, for example, one of the one of the things the Vatican does pretty well is to run its own diplomatic corps. They have diplomatic representatives, more than 100 of them, scattered all over the world, and they have to finance the lodgings and the offices and the communications set up for this. They also have to run Vatican Radio, and there's now Vatican Television.
So I believe that the Vatican or the Holy See was in at the very beginning of the United Nations after the Second World War. That's and have right. observer status in Geneva
That's
and
right.
in New York.
They
Is
do.
That correct?
They do. Yeah. They do. And, of course, the Pope on his, the current Pope on his visits to the United States did address the United Nations.
And came through Geneva on the last visit.
And,
yeah.
and was very pleased to visit some of the international organisations in Geneva. But as I stress yet again, what is interesting about this Pope is the way that he has managed to draw interest to the minor places which hitherto have not really been associated very much with the Catholic Church, or which have very small Catholic populations. One of the things that he did in very early on in his pontificate was to go to the island of Lampedusa, a small island off the coast of southern Italy, to visit the refugees who had been fleeing to Europe. He's very conscious that this is one of the great problems of our time. So climate change, refugees, poverty, these are the priorities.
And one last question, again an unfair question, but you know much more about this than I do and people listening in. Would it be fair to say that the Italians would like to have the the papacy back after a poll and now in Argentine? And God bless him that he lives a long time, but and would that be a good thing that the Italians get it back, or is it going to travel the world a little bit more and spread its wings?
Very difficult to know the result of the next conclave. There will be heavy competition between those who are members of the Electoral College who support the Pope and those basically who have criticised, been very critical of him, including many American bishops, unfortunately. But I would have thought that having started the practice of having a non-Italian Pope, we stand a very good chance of getting another non-Italian Pope. There's speculation, of course, of the last conclave that there might be an African. I think it's unlikely to have that we shall have an African Pope, but it is very possible we could get an Asian Pope for the first time. There is also a particular dark horse who is considered a potential contender for the papacy, a priest that we know here who was very active in social affairs and is now the Cardinal Archbishop of Bologna. He's been promoted very quickly and his name is being touted as a future pope. But I really wouldn't like to place any bets at the moment on who's likely to take over when Francis goes. But for the moment, he seems to be doing fairly well. He's had to cancel a couple of foreign trips this summer, but he does intend to go to Canada and he seems very active even from his wheelchair.
Okay, David Woolley, thank you so much for all those fascinating insights. Remember, listeners, that you heard it first on the McKay interview coming out of Rome itself. My guest today has been David Woolley, dear friend, papal biographer and former BBC correspondent for the Vatican for many, many, many years, and we hope many, many more to come. Thank you, David Woolley.
Thank you.
That was the McKay interview with Michael McKay. And don't forget, you can hear that interview again on our website, worldradio.ch.